Hi, this is Allison Sheridan of the No Silica Cast podcast, hosted to podfeed.com, a technology geek podcast with an ever so slight Macintosh bias. Today is Sunday, July 30th, 2006, and this is show number 53. You're probably thinking, hey, it's not Sunday the 30th of July. It's a lot closer to July 21st, so what's going on? Well, I've pre-recorded two shows for while I'm on vacation, and I couldn't figure out how to post them while I'm gone, so I'm doing them ahead of time. But you better wait until around July 30th, or you're going to have a long dry spell waiting for the No Silica Cast to come back. Today's show is the second installment of Ron David's interview with Faye Wells. If you missed show number 52, definitely go back and listen to that one first, especially since I explained to you who Ron David and Faye Wells actually are. It'll make a lot more sense to you. Without further ado, I've always wanted to say that, here's Ron and Faye.
Faye was born in 1908. Linton Wells, the man she would eventually marry, was 15 years her senior, but was spun of the same cloth. Although they didn't wed right away, Lint and Faye were meant for each other. His exploits were many and varied. He was even the only person to fly as a passenger on one leg of the Army's famous round-the-world flight in 1924. Afterwards, he and Army pilot Lee Wade became lifelong friends. Before we meet Lint, though, we'll talk a little more about Faye's flying exploits, hear about a close scrape with romance in the Far East, and we'll also return to 1929 and the formation of the 99s, who brought Faye and Amelia Earhart together. Amelia was already famous for having become the first woman to cross the Atlantic by air, although merely as a passenger. She confided to friends like Faye that she might as well have been a sack of potatoes on that flight. But because of the notoriety it generated, Amelia was determined to become a record setter in her own right. And she did, leaving us with a mystery about her disappearance that has intrigued the world ever since. Chapter 2 of my conversation with Faye.
You had a chance to fly in some very unique places. I know that you flew tiger moths and where, the Far East?
Oh, yes. Well, that was just... I just happened to be in Penang when the British formed the first aviation club out there in the Far East, and so they gave me a chance to fly with them. And it just happened. I mean, you were on this trip from Tokyo to Athens, Greece, to go back to Russia, and I didn't want to go back by the Trans-Siberian, so I jumped a freighter and came by the Chit system. You know, and the Chit system means that you get a letter. I had a letter from the manager of the National City Bank in Tokyo. And he gave me a letter to the National City Bank manager in Shanghai. So when the boat landed in Shanghai, well, I went up to see the manager, and he entertained me there for 2 or 3 days while he was unloading and loading. And then he gave me a letter to the manager in Hong Kong, and they had to wait there a while, so I took another boat over to the Philippines to see my uncle, who is the head of the agricultural department at the University of the Philippines. And then I went back and to Hong Kong, and he gave me a letter to the manager in the bank in Singapore. And we got to Singapore, and they said, well, we'll have to stay here 10 days because the cargo hasn't come in. And so this manager said, well, you can't stay on this ship for 10 days. And he said, you come stay with me. It's perfectly all right because my sister is staying with me. Isn't that cute? So I stayed with him for 10 days. And while I was there, the manager of the bank from Shanghai came down to Singapore because the National Bank had a lot of interest in the rubber plantations in Malaysia. And so we took a 4-day trip through Malaysia to see the rubber plantations. They said, oh, you come with us and we'll... There's no point in staying in Singapore doing nothing. And so that's when I got to make the flight in Penang. So anyhow, that's the way with everything goes like that. Just happens.
One of those bank presidents fell in love with you, didn't they?
Oh, yeah, this crazy guy in Shanghai. We always had lunch on the porch at Raffles in Singapore. It was just heaven. And so this guy decided, well, he thought he'd like to marry me. And I thought, well, you know, it might be kind of funny being in Shanghai and whoop-de-doo, you know. And then I remembered that he had this very exuberant Russian girl in Shanghai. And I knew she wasn't going to like this. And so I decided I wouldn't marry him. I mean, I wasn't in love with him. I'm sure he wasn't in love with me. I just thought it was a good, might be a fun idea or something. I don't know. Anyhow, so the last day I was there, he had two violinists come and play us while we were having our last luncheon on the porch at Raffles Hotel in Singapore. And I went on the plane, on the boat to Athens.
You did a lot of traveling around.
Yeah.
You and Lynn both.
Yeah. Oh, well, he went around the world four times before I ever met him.
Tell me a little bit about Linton.
Well, he was a wild, a wild reporter. He took every opportunity he could to get a story. And he was in Shanghai when the first round the world flight came. The army flew around 1924.
Sure.
And so he went up to the Kuril Islands to pick them up, and they came in across the Bering Sea. And then he couldn't, were ready to leave, so he had to come back by train and boat to Shanghai. So he was in Shanghai by the time the planes got in, because they were always breaking down and taking, you know, it took them 5.5 months to go around the world. So he met the whole gang in Shanghai, and they had a great time. And he thought, well, you know, they're going on down the coast. So he went down to Hong Kong with them. I mean, not with them, but he met them in Hong Kong. And then he thought, gee, they're going to Calcutta. I think I'll get to Calcutta and meet them there. So he did. He met them in Calcutta. And at that point, Lee Wade's co-pilot hurt his back. They had to take the engine out to repair it in some way. And he lifted the engine out, and he hurt his back. And so Lint stepped in and said, told Lee that he would help him out any way he could, you know. And they said, he said, I'll even go to Karachi with you. So Lee said, well, I can't take you until I get permission from the general. So they sent off a telegram to the general in Washington asking permission for Linton Wells to fly with them. And they came time to take off, and they hadn't heard from the general. And so they said, well, no news is good news. So they took off, and they spent 5 days. It was only a two-seater plane. And so they had to put a board across the seat, and Linton and this guy, I don't know what his name was, sat on this board all the way across the desert. And dust was blown in their faces because they were up above the windshield. And so they finally got to Karachi, 5 days. And at Karachi, they got this irate telegram from the general saying, under no circumstances can you take Linton Wells with you.
Now, who was Lynn working for then?
He's working for the AP, and he also had a telegram from the AP and said, you're fired. You're supposed to be covering Shanghai, not the round-the-world flyers in Calcutta. So he was fired. He was caught in Karachi.
Now, what happened to him when he got fired? Now, he's out of a job, and he's sitting in Karachi.
That's all right. He's ingenious. He decided there's no point in going back to Shanghai. He's out of a job, and he's already in Karachi, just across the border from Europe. So he went to Rome and got the first exclusive interview with Mussolini, who was just coming up in the world. And then he got to the Rome, and then somehow then he said, well, I might as well go on to London. So he went to London and found that the round-the-world flyers were going to come into London, and also that the Prince of Wales was going to make a tour of America. So, of course, he maneuvered and got on the Prince of Wales's entourage as a reporter, and he and the prince went out to the airport and met the round-the-world flyers in London when they came in. And then he and the prince took the boat to New York, and they were in New York when they went out to the Mitchell Field and welcomed the round-the-world flyers in Mitchell Field.
So going by boat, Lynn actually got to New York.
Lee Wade's plane went down in the middle of the Atlantic, you know, and he was rescued, and they gave him another plane to finish his trip, because anyhow.
Now, he and Lee became friends, didn't they?
Oh, yes, and after this trip, he and Lee just tried to figure out what they could do would be different. And so they said, well, nobody has made a nonstop automobile flight across America, drive across America. So they went to Detroit to try and get somebody to, Packard or somebody, to give them a car. And they couldn't get anybody to give them a car because they said, you know, you can't do it. And then we'd get bad publicity because the plane car would break down, and then he said the package no good, it broke down. So they didn't believe that their cars could make it. So they had to buy a car. And so they bought a car, and then they bought a dolly, so that when they had a flat tire, they put the wheel on the dolly and repair it while it's still going, because this is going to be a nonstop flight drive. So, and they had 5-gallon cans of gasoline in the back seat. It was all loaded with cans of gasoline, so they didn't have to stop. And
so when they said nonstop, they meant nonstop. In other words, they left from the East Coast, went to the West Coast, and they never stopped the car one time.
Right.
They did maintenance on it, changed flat tires.
Yeah.
Added fuel.
Yeah.
And got there. Do you remember what kind of car they drove?
I think it was a Packard.
Oh, that was a pretty
good
car.
I don't know what's in his book. His book's in there. Anyhow, they made it. And then while he was in Detroit trying to buy the car, he met a man by the name of Ed Evans. And Mr. Evans was head of the company that installed the chocks that the cars were held in place with, like when they were put on the cargo plane, cargo platforms to take them from New York, you know, from Detroit to New York or wherever. And so when he got finished with the trip to New York with Lee Wade, Ed Evans, somehow they got together, and he said he'd like to make a trip around the world. He was the first one to make a trip around the world, or break the record. And so Lynn had nothing to do except he said, okay, I'll go. And he said, well, you take my son around. You go around the world and make the arrangements at these various places for our official papers that we need to go from one to the other, and what the opportunities are to get airplanes to fly from here to there and so on. And you take my son with you so that he can have experience of going around the world. And Lynn said he spent most of his time to get this kid out of the bars at night, you know. But anyhow, so then the next year, he and Ed Evans went around the world in 28 days, going by boat across Europe to Europe, and then flying through to Berlin and across Siberia, and then taking the boat from Japan back to America. And they did it in 28 days.
That was a remarkable time back then.
Yeah, but
He did a lot of pretty wild things. Tell me about the time that he went out and got a story from people who had survived a sinking ship.
Oh, yeah. Well, there was a ship that went down off Honolulu, and the survivors were coming back. They were bringing them back to America. And he said, well, nobody's interviewed these people. We don't know what happened, what made the boat sink and all this kind of stuff. And so when they were about 12 hours outside of Los Angeles, he got a plane, an amphibian, and he went out and he came alongside the boat, and then he jumped out of the plane. The guy went down low and he jumped out of the plane, and then the ship had to stop and pick him up, because that's what you do. You pick up people in trouble at sea, you know. So they had to stop and pick him up. And so then he got aboard and he interviewed these people for about 4 hours. Then the amphibian came back and landed, and he jumped off the ship. And he got about an 8-hour lead on everybody else on the story. I mean, he went to all that trouble to get a scoop on this, these people coming home and found out what they happened to him. And his whole life was doing things like that.
Now, your dad said you got to get a job or go back to school, so you got a job with Curtis. And you went around the country and met all these wonderful people. Who among them stood out in your mind the most? Who did you like? Who had some real quality or was a real daredevil, somebody that was a real character?
Well, I don't know. I was in such awe of all of them because I had never met anybody like this that did all these wonderful things in airplanes. And of course, I was interested because I didn't do it, and I thought maybe I could do it someday. And I don't know, I always liked Jimmy Doolittle and his wife. They were a wonderful pair.
And well, he accomplished a lot in aviation, Jimmy did.
And Jimmy and Jimmy Doolittle and Joe was his wife, Josephine, they called her Joe. And, I don't know.
How about Roscoe?
I met all these women, you know, the women pilots. I met all of them in 1929. And after the girls in 29 had had the first air race, they decided they wanted to keep in touch. And they asked Amelia if she would try and help organize something so they could have an organization, a very casual organization. And so she said, yes, she would do it. And when she came back to New York, why, that's when I was just starting to work with Curtis. And so she went to Mr. Lawrence, who was head of the public relations department at Curtis, and asked him if he'd like to help. And he thought of the 117 women pilots. Yes, I'll help. And so he had his secretary, a girl by the name of Claire Trinkman, write a letter. And then he had the four girls who were working for Curtis at the time. We all signed the letter that went out to the 117 women pilots saying they were going to have this organization. And if they were interested, well, we were going to have a meeting November the 2nd, 1929, at the Curtis Field in Valley Stream, Long Island. And just to show up. I mean, they didn't have to RSVP, but if they could come, why, they could come. And so so we had the meeting in November the 2nd in Valley Stream, and 26 women showed up. And they had this argument about what they would call themselves. And of course, there were two sides. One would want to be the very serious American Organization of Women Pilots, you know, hot stuff. And the others wanted to be called the Laybirds or the Gadflies or the High Flyers or something like that, frivolous, you know. And finally, this went on and on. And finally this quiet voice in the back of the room said, why don't we name ourselves after our number of charter members? And that was Amelia Earhart, and I didn't even know she was in the room, because they just came in and sat down, and I'd been out flying to the Long Island Country Club talking to a bunch of Boy Scouts, and I came in, and I had to help set up the cookies and the tea and whatnot, and I didn't have time to change my clothes, and I thought, well, it's a women's pilots meeting, and that they'll all come in pilot's clothes because they'll be flying in, you know. And of course, they all turned up with gloves and close hats and all dressed to the nines. And I'm sitting here, the only one in the bunch with the dirty coveralls on. I've never lived down that picture. I mean, the original group of the 99s is all there. And I was the secretary sitting over in one corner with a dirty pair of coveralls on.
You dressed kind of like that picture right there?
Yeah. I even kept my helmet and goggles on. I mean, it was so ridiculous. I'm inside the hangar. I don't know what I was thinking of.
Well, maybe your hair was a mess. You didn't want to take your helmet off.
But it was my first meeting with women pilots, and, you know, a group of women pilots like that. And I was so overawed because I'd read about all these women in the papers that had been in the air race. You know, that's why I took up aviation, was because these women were going to make the air race.
So your real-life heroes were right there before you?
Yeah, they were all right there.
26 or 28 people?
26.
26. And eventually it became...
Well, then we had to write, when we agreed we were going to have the organization, then we wrote another letter. And 99 out of the 117 responded. And so that's why we were called the 99s. And so I've been spending 72 years explaining who the 99s are. Gave me something to do, you know.
Well, I hope you enjoyed this fabulous interview with an amazing lady. I'm so glad Ron captured her voice and her stories. It was just a great thing that he did there. Part of my motivation in playing these wonderful interview segments was to really push Ron to finally get going on doing his own podcast. He really wants to do it, and I think he'd be a great contribution to the podcasting community. So, if you want to hear more, please email Ron at rondavid@gmail.com and ask him to get started on doing a podcast. As always, you can always email me your comments, suggestions, and questions at allison@podfeet.com. Thanks for listening, and stay subscribed.